It's a great pleasure to have Nick Kemp with us today. He's a third-year PhD student at MIT, and he will tell us about the latest results of MicroBoom. So please take it away, Nick.
Great, yeah, thanks, Matthias, and thanks for inviting me. And like Matthias said, I'm here to tell you about MicroBoom's first results looking at the MiniBoom Low Energy Excess. Today's story is a story about neutrinos. And as you'll probably know in this room, neutrinos won the Nobel Prize in 2015 for the confirmation of the neutrino oscillation phenomenon. And this is a phenomenon where if you create neutrinos in one weak flavor eigenstate and you let them propagate over some distance, there's some non-zero probability to detect them in a different flavor eigenstate. And you can see an example for reactor antineutrinos here in the bottom plot. The neutrino oscillation phenomenon arises because the three flavor eigenstates for neutrinos in the standard model are not the same as the three mass eigenstates. And so in general, they're related by this 3x3 unitary mixing matrix, the PM&S matrix. And the flavor eigenstates and vice can be thought of as linear superpositions of the mass eigenstates kind of depicted pictorially on the right here and vice versa. And so the observation of oscillations between these three flavor states imply that neutrinos have small, but it turns out non-zero masses. And this is because if you write down, you can calculate the probability to detect a neutrino in a different flavor eigenstate beta after creating it in an eigenstate alpha. The oscillation probability depends on the sum over PM&S mixing matrix elements, as well as these exponentials of the mass squared of the neutrino mass eigenstates, the propagated distance L, and the neutrino energy E. And if you make an approximation that there are two flavor states and two mass eigenstates, that unitary matrix becomes just a 2x2 orthogonal matrix. And you can write down the two neutrino approximation for the oscillation probability here, where you have an amplitude term, theta being the angle between the flavor and the mass states. And then you have this oscillating term, which depends on the mass squared difference between the two eigenstates, the distance traveled L, and the neutrino energy E. So this has been a really successful picture of the three neutrinos in the standard model. There have been a number of experiments that look at neutrinos from accelerators, from reactors, atmospheric-generated neutrinos, solar-generated neutrinos that have fit this three neutrino mixing paradigm quite well. We've set strong constraints on the mixing parameters and the mass squared differences for the three neutrinos in the standard model. However, there are a couple of anomalies that are difficult to explain within this picture. So there are sort of three sets of anomalies. The first are these short baseline accelerator anomalies, really just the LS&D and MiniBoom anomalies, which look for electron neutrinos from a source that's predominantly muon neutrinos. This is usually from proton beam dump experiments. And they see both LS&D and MiniBoom in excess of electron or anti-electron neutrinos compared to what they would expect. There's also reactor neutrinos, which look for anti-electron neutrinos from neutrino reactors. And the reactor anti-neutrino anomaly is a situation in which these experiments measure a rate that's about 7% smaller than the theoretical expectation. However, there's some caveats in this picture. There's been a lot of recent work into the reactor neutrino flux. And so I will put, I don't have an asterisk on the slide, but I would put an asterisk on the reactor anomalies. But in any case, there's also a third set of anomalies, the gallium anomalies, which take a radioactive source that produces electron neutrinos and looks for the capture of those electron neutrinos onto a gallium detector. And these experiments, in general, observe a deficit of the capture rate compared to what they might expect from the standard model cross-section. And so the most recent result here, which I show a plot on the bottom right for, is the BEST experiment, which sees about a 4 sigma deficit of electron neutrino captures. And so these anomalies are very difficult to accommodate within the standard three neutrino mixing paradigm that we've sort of over-constrained today. And so explanations of these anomalies, at least originally, often involve the addition of a fourth sterile neutrino to your neutrino picture. So you have a fourth mass eigenstate and a fourth flavor eigenstate that facilitates oscillations at a shorter baseline. But I'll put an asterisk here, and I'll come back to this point later. There's quite a bit of tension in the global picture when you try to consider an EV scale sterile neutrino to explain these anomalies.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How much of this depends on this oscillation picture And so how well we know the initial wave function?
Yeah, so there's been some recent work on this. So the wave packet matters for certain experiments more than others, depending on like the compact, like what source they're generated from, and like the energy that you're working with. It turns out reactor experiments this matters a lot. So there's a paper by Carlos Arguelles and some others that actually goes through the wave packet oscillation probability, and you get some. It does have some impact on the constraints from reactor experiments on the sterile neutrino picture. I think that's where it's most impacted. It also impacts some of the gallium experiments. I think in the accelerator, like Minimoon and LSMU cases, it doesn't have much of an effect just based on the energies and baselines that you're considering there. But I can point you to that paper if you want more detail.
It's only ever something that's worth discussing in the context of EV sterile neutrinos, because for the normal frequencies, the mass splitting is too small, and you need a tiny, tiny wave packet to see some incoherence effect or something like that. It's because here the mass splitting is larger, then you don't need such a tiny wave packet size to see new effects.
Yeah.
And I would argue what you need, so Carlos's paper using this wave packet size to try and modify the interpretation of reactor data is too small of a wave packet to be compatible with your energy uncertainty in the detection.
Yeah.
Like just the uncertainty that you have from experimental measurement is much larger than the wave packet size, and that matters more, I would argue. But that's a different...
I see.
Yeah.
So I guess that even LSMD, they detect electrons. In practice, they detect electrons. And gallium, what does it detect?
You can actually do sort of a radiochemical analysis where you look for, I think it's gallium capture. I forget. You create a new isotope. I think it's germanium. I'd have to. It might not be. Yeah, you could do a counting experiment. I forget the exact way that they count. But yeah, that's the idea. They let it, they expose it to the source for a while, and then they, I think they can use the de-excitation of the final state nucleus to like tag photons from that de-excitation and like isolate the product of the electron captured. Yeah.
But I should point out, LSMD and Minimoon are appearance experiments, meaning you don't expect to see anything and then you see some amount of electrons. Well, gallium reactors are disappearance, so you will see a lot of stuff, but then they observe a significant deficit of that stuff.
So those can you explain a bit more why that is? Because
so,
it's not...
Sure.
Yeah. Maybe Nick wants to...
Maybe you will say more.
Yeah, let's see. Do I talk about it? You don't mind me skipping a bunch of slides. I have some. Sorry. Spoiler alert. I talk more about sterile neutrinos later. Maybe I can get to it then, but just I'll flash the equations. Here we go. Yeah, so if you introduce this sterile neutrino to your picture, you get a 4x4 mixing matrix, and you introduce these new oscillation channels when you have this EV scale sterile neutrino. There's an appearance channel where you get muon 2 electron oscillations at a shorter baseline than you would naively guess from the 3 neutrino picture. And then you also impact the survival probability of muon neutrinos and electron neutrinos. And you can see these expressions depend on the new entries to the PMNS matrix, as well as this new delta M squared. So the idea here is that your delta M squared is higher. It's like EV scale for the sterile neutrino. And if you just look at this oscillation expression here, that means that your L has to go down if you want to stay at the oscillation maxima. And so you get effects that short baselines. So that's why most of these anomalies are short baseline anomalies. But you can get, in general, enhanced muon to electron neutrino appearance and then disappearance. And if you want to do a robust analysis of Minimoon, you would consider all of these channels. There's disappearance of the intrinsic electron neutrinos in the beam, of the muon neutrinos in the beam. And so people have done that. It's not a huge effect.
Understand
the model,
so
Okay, one second, sorry.
Or maybe you'll talk about that?
I'll talk about it for at least the Marker Boon case, which is sort of a follow-up to Mini Boon. I can sort of roughly, I mean, usually it's your uncertainty in the flux and the cross-section that's setting these. So let's see, we're talking about the uncertainties in this plot here. So in all of these plots, I mean, I think the reactor uncertainties here come, I think, predominantly from the quoted flux uncertainties on your theoretical model. This is the Hebe-Müller flux. For the appearance cases, there's, you know, statistical errors are quite large in LSD, but there's systematic errors on, you know, your understanding of the flux. This is a decay at rest pion source. I know the Mini Boon error is a lot better. So there's uncertainties on, you know, the flux from the BNB. There's uncertainties on your CCQE cross section, which is predominantly what they measure at these energies. And then there's uncertainties on the optical model of the detector. So it's using, you know, Cherenkov rings from photons from these charged particles that get created. And so there's some uncertainty in how those photons propagate. But those are the major sources of uncertainty in Mini Boon, for example, which is what I'll talk about mostly. I don't know if you had it specific.
But I, on LSND, that blue region is fit to a signal. The excess is comparing the data to the green plus red.
Oh, that's a great, yeah. That's something that I think is not obvious on this plot. Yeah, so we've gone and like altered this plot to get rid of the blue, and I should have grabbed that one. Yeah.
99.99% of the time.
Yeah, so the standard model, or, you know. It looks fun, yeah, but what you should be comparing to is the green and the red here. That's the prediction without sterile oscillations, and the blue is the...
What I was trying to say before is that your appearance, meaning you only have kind of mis-ID background, stuff that shouldn't be the neutrinos you're looking for. While the others are disappearance experiments, meaning you expected to measure some normalization of neutrinos, but some of them have disappeared. So you have to know the systematics on the second case is very important. On the first case, it's also important if your detector is picking up a lot of background, which is the case for Mini Boon, not so much so for LSMP.
Okay, so then let's just put in the
You can.
It's hard.
Yeah. So
But that cross section has several inputs from other places.
Yeah. So I guess Mini Boon has done some work on this. So you can look at this and say, well, the pinot background is massive where the excess is peaking. But they do some measurements of like the pinot rate. Or they have a dedicated pinot measurement that sort of constrains that cross section, like in situ. External groups have done analyses where they consider different event generators or different models of the cross section and whether those can accommodate the excess, and in general, you can't really accommodate the excess based on a different. They've looked specifically for changes to the delta to N gamma contribution in this like orange, yellowish region, and in the pi naught cross section, and it's difficult to. Like, I think the excess, the statement is the excess still sits above the uncertainties on those channels.
Someone was talking about some of the Mini Boon excess possibly being attributable to parts of the beam interacting sort of off-axis and creating more neutrinos than you're expecting, like in material.
Yeah, so like beam scraping the sides of the target or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, so this is something I know that nominally in the model that that Mini Boon uses for the BNB, they do account for some of this scraping, but it's not something that's been investigated a whole lot. It's something that we are looking into, actually, but
for that you expect to see that in the muon channel.
Possibly, but if it's just a low energy phenomenon, I'm not sure.
It depends. Yeah, and it depends which neutrinos you're generating. Maybe there's some source of extra electron neutrinos. It's an interesting question. You have to do a lot of digging into the specific BNB simulation, and it's a dated simulation, so that. Has its difficulties, but it is something we're thinking about. Exhaust standard model possibilities is a good philosophy. So I'll talk mostly about the Mini Boon anomaly in at least the Marker Boon part of this talk. We've gone over this now. It's an excess of electron neutrino-like events in a predominantly muon neutrino beam. It's been tested by Marker Boon, which is a liquid argon time projection chamber. Gives more detailed event-by-event information. And so I'll present the first results from Marker Boon today that look for a similar excess in the same beamline. So a brief outline of the talk. I'll go into a bit more detail. Let me see if I can get rid of this. On the Mini-Boon anomaly, and then I'll talk about the Markerboon experiment. I'll spend most of the time talking about Markerboon's first results. And then if we have some time at the end, I want to talk about the coherent Captain Mills experiment at Los Alamos, which is doing some interesting things looking for dark sector models at a decay arrest pion source. So hopefully we can get to that. But I'll start with the Mini-Boon anomaly. So Mini-Boon is this 800-ton liquid or mineral oil Cherenkov detector that sits on the booster neutrino beam at Fermilab about 500 meters away from the beryllium target. I think I've said all of these things. So Mini-Boon was originally designed to test the oscillation interpretation of the LS&D excess. So if you remember, oscillations depend on the ratio of L over E. So Mini-Boon is built with the same roughly L over E ratio as LS&D, but both are increased by about an order of magnitude. So it's a completely different experiment. So sort of you can see a general picture of the Mini-Boon experiment here. You have 8 GeV protons from the Fermilab booster that hit the beryllium target. You focus your charged mesons from the spallation in the target, and they decay in this 50-meter decay region into a sort of collimated neutrino beam, which you can then detect after some amount of propagation distance in Mini-Boon, and also Markerboon, which sits about 70 meters in front of Mini-Boon. So Cherenkov detectors use the topology of Cherenkov rings to do their particle identification. So in Mini-Boon, electrons look like these fuzzy Cherenkov rings that sort of on the left side here. And this is due to the multiple scattering of electrons in the detector, the Breming of electrons and pair productions. So you get this electromagnetic shower that shows up as a fuzzier ring. You also have muons, which are minimum ionizing particles in Mini-Boon. And so these deposit these clean rings or these filled-in rings from long straight tracks through the detector. And then you have things like neutral pions that are created in resonant neutrino scattering events where you get two photon rings, so two fuzzy-ish rings that you can see on the right here. And Mini-Boon's excess is in the electron-like channel, so it's really an excess of these fuzzy Cherenkov rings that they see. So there are some limitations from using a Cherenkov detector. Electrons and photons behave the same way. They both create electromagnetic showers, and that's why you have these huge photon-like backgrounds, or true photon backgrounds, I should say, in the Mini-Boon excess coming from misidentified pi naughts or neutral current delta decays to a single photon. And then also, you don't have any hadronic information in Mini-Boon. This is because protons are below the Cherenkov threshold, and so you only detect the charged lepton in the final state. And so this means the excess could be a number of different things. It could be a mismodeled photon background, and that's what a lot of people have spent time thinking about. It could be an electron-like excess, so driven by, for example, sterile oscillations facilitating new mu to new e appearance at short baselines. It could be a more exotic new physics, too. So there's a number of dark sector models that create E plus E minus pairs that would also look like a single electromagnetic shower in the Mini-Boon detector if they're sufficiently collimated. And so this is also a potential. There's a number of these models that can also explain the Mini-Boon excess. And so what one really wants to do is perform a robust experimental test of the Mini-Boon anomaly. And for that, you want a detector that gives you more detailed information than the sort of coarse Cherenkov detector. So you do get some rough position information. So in this latest, so this is Mini-Boon's paper with their complete data set, and they do some studies of the excess in the radial distribution. And it turns out that, you know, pi naught events that you miss ID tend to peak, and of course dirt events tend to peak near the edges of the detector because you lose one of the photons, for example. The excess is peaked a bit more toward the center, so you can use that to get a sense of. So this is one of the reasons Mini-Boon doesn't think their excess is pi naught misidentification.
The smaller their fiducial volume, the higher the significance.
Yeah, that's a good point.
On backgrounds, and then it just so happens that the rate scales in the right way. So I think it goes over 5 sigma if they choose the right radius. But
yeah, there's a good table in there. Of course, you're like making cuts after you get your data now, but it's an interesting thing to look at how the excess scales. Markerboon is important to test this this excess really robustly. And so Markerboon is a liquid argon time projection chamber that sits just 70 meters in front of Mini-Boon. You can see it being lowered into its facility LRTF along the same beamline. It's designed to directly address the miniboon anomaly. And you do that using LARTPC technology, which gives you, instead of just strand cuff rings, you get these really nice images of neutrino interactions in your detector, where neutrinos from the beam are coming from the left, interacting at some vertex and creating a number of charged particles in the final state. For example, on the left, this looks sort of like an electromagnetic shower. So that might be an electron. You get a straight track. That might be a proton. And so this might be a one electron, one proton charged current quasi-elastic scattering event. So how does LARTPC work? Very quick explanation. So at least in the Markerboom case, you get incoming neutrinos that interact in some charged current interaction, create charged particles in the final state. As these particles propagate through the detector, you're ionizing argon atoms. And you'll get free ionization electrons along the path of these charged particles. You can drift those ionization electrons across your detector to a series of wire planes. And these give you two-dimensional information about the trajectory of the charged particles through the detector. Along the path of the charged particles, the argon ions can also recombine and emit scintillation light, which allows you to, this is fast nanosecond scale scintillation light, so you can get the initial time of the event. And then you can detect these photons with PMTs around the detector. And you can use that to estimate the drift time of the electrons from the track to the wire planes. And that gives you your third dimension. So you can do 3D reconstruction of the charged particle tracks through the detector. So Markerboom is a 170-ton LARTPC. It's the largest LARTPC to operate in the United States to date. It gets order millimeter scale spatial resolution. It has the ability to reconstruct hadronic activity, which is important. Protons will also ionize argon atoms. So that's an important advantage over Miniboon. And it's made a number of important contributions to LARTPCs. I won't list them all, but I'll draw your attention to this bottom right part of the screen, where you see what a one electron, one proton CCQE event would look like in Miniboon, where you just get the fuzzy ring from the Cherenkov detector. And then in Markerboom, you get a very clean proton and electron coming from a neutrino interaction vertex. So just by eye, you can see there's a lot more information there. Yep. No, it's a constant electric field. It's about, the design was about 500 volts per centimeter. Yeah, it doesn't have to be much, but you just need to. You need to be able to drift your electrons before they capture. So that is limited by the impurities in your detector. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So this is the some pictures of the Markerboom detector. You can see the field cage assembly here, the top left. The cryostat is about the size of a school bus. You can see people for scale here. Yeah, the nice thing, so just an explicit demonstration of the power of LARTPC. You can do really good, you can at least get a handle on your photon electron discrimination. And there's sort of two ways that you can do this. One is that photons travel some distance before converting, about 10 centimeters or so, into an E plus E minus pair. And so there's some gap from the vertex. And so if you can figure out where the vertex is, you can look for these gaps. And that's indicative of a photon-generated electromagnetic shower. The other is that the trunk of the electromagnetic shower, photons will have, on average, twice the dEdx as electrons. And that's because photons are seeded by E plus E minus pairs that have roughly the same energy. And so you get twice the energy deposition per unit length. And so you can look for that. You can measure the dEdx at the trunk of the shower. And that gives you another PID handle. So the Markerboom data set, so the data that we've taken came from 2015 to 2021. Running in the booster neutrino beam. And the analyses that we've released for our first results cover about the first 7 E20 POT, and we have a bit less than double that on tape. So there's more data to be analyzed. So I'll now spend a fair bit of time talking about Markerboom's first results. So what do we test in Markerboom's first results? There's three different analyses that have looked for electron neutrinos in the booster neutrino beam. And this tests whether the excess is due in some way to an enhancement of electron neutrinos in the BNB. There's also an analysis that's looked for an enhancement of neutral current delta to single photon decays in the detector. This is the only photon background that Miniboom doesn't constrain in situ, so that's an important analysis to do. Markerboom hasn't yet performed a generic single photon search. As the source for NXS, but these analyses are underway, so stay tuned for generic single photon searches to come out soon for MicroBoon. For the electron analyses, we've used a simplified model of the low energy excess to determine whether we see an excess of electron neutrinos. And to do this, we take a miniboon's data and we unfold it based on the prediction, unfold it compared to the prediction under an assumption that the excess comes entirely from an enhancement of electron neutrinos in the booster neutrino beam. And so what we get from this unfolding process is a series of weights as a function of true neutrino energy, which you can then apply to charged current neutrino action, neutrino interactions to get a sense of what the enhancement would look like in MicroBoon. And as you can see, since MiniBoon is a low energy excess, these weights are peaking toward low true neutrino energies. This is designed to be as physics agnostic as possible, at least for the first results. There are some caveats to that. There are, you know, are some baked in assumptions into this method. One is that we assume that the MiniBoon excess would have the same neutrino energy dependence in MicroBoon. So that's an important point. But in general, it's a physics agnostic way to get a sense of whether you see the same excess. So there are three different electron neutrino results. There's a search for a very pure sample of two-body CCQE events. There is a MiniBoon-like sample that looks for electron neutrino interactions without a pion in the final state. So charged pions would not show up in MiniBoon's electron-like channel. You'd see the other Cherenkov ring. And then finally, there's an inclusive sample that looks for any electron neutrino interaction. So these three analyses have been developed independently. They start with the same data, but they use different reconstruction tools to isolate their sample of electron neutrinos. So I'll talk more about the two-body CCQE analysis, which is what our group worked on at MIT. But if you're interested in the other analyses, there's plenty of details in the papers if you want more. So the philosophy of the CCQE analysis, in a nutshell, is that we leverage image-based deep learning techniques to isolate our sample of highly pure electron neutrino interactions in MicroBoon. And to do this, we use a very specific signal definition. We're looking for CCQE events with one electron and one proton in the final state. And these requirements give us strong kinematic and topological handles on the event selection. So the motivation for using CCQE is that the quasi-elastic cross-section is dominant around the peak of the MiniBoon excess. So at the lowest energies, you know, 200 to 500 MeV, the dominant neutrino interactions are quasi-elastic, and also those cross-sections, at least at the low like hundreds of MeV energy scales, are better understood than, for example, the resonant cross-sections. And so this gives you a nice reduction of systematic errors in your cross-section model. The topology is really simple. We're looking for one proton and one electromagnetic shower coming from the same vertex. I'm going to take a quick drink of water, but if anyone has any questions at this point, go ahead. Okay.
The resonant contribution is still sizable in the BNB.
That's true. So you can.
And CCQE in your images doesn't mean CCQE in the event.
Right? This is true.
Like the resonant can look like CCQE because of the nuclear absorption and so on. So
this is
something that in principle you rely on models.
Well, we do rely on models from Genie, but we also have some handles to sort of reduce this pion absorption background. And so this is where the kinematic handles are important. So even if you get pion absorption within the nucleus, the kinematics of your final state particles will be less CCQE-like. For example, CCQE requires a few things. A true CCQE event will have a forward-going proton. So you can look for a forward-going proton. I think the thing that really beats down these pion absorption resonant backgrounds is that we can reconstruct our energy in a number of different ways. So we do a calorimetric reconstruction, and then you can also reconstruct your neutrino energy under the assumption that it was a CCQE event. So you can use either the proton or the lepton kinematics. And we don't make any strong requirements, but if you require these three different energy definitions to be roughly consistent with one another, you can get rid of events that aren't true CCQE. So this is, we use a BDT with these variables, so we don't make explicit cuts.
Because because your backgrounds are small in this search, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you also see a plot of like true CCQE versus not true CCQE. Okay, so the deep learning motivation for our analysis is pretty clear. These are high resolution images, so we should use image-based machine learning techniques, or at least it's a strong case to use them. Like I said before, we get sort of order millimeter scale spatial resolution. And so this lends itself to the use of machine learning techniques like convolutional neural networks. And so this is our analysis chain for the CCQE analysis. It's a mix of sort of traditional reconstruction algorithms, as well as a couple CNN-based algorithms. I'll just touch on a few of the pieces of this analysis chain, probably the ones that are more interesting. So the first is our semantic segmentation, CNN.
So,
yes.
For
Miniboon, the dominant backgrounds are these misidentified photons from Pinot decays or delta to N gamma decays. In Markerboon, we do get the backgrounds from that are much smaller because you can tag the hadronic activity too. We do get some backgrounds from, for example, for our analysis, we're looking for like a straight track and an electromagnetic shower. And if you get a muon from a neutrino interaction or cosmic muon that stops and decays, the Michel plus the muon can sort of mimic that event. And that shows up predominantly at lower energies. Our backgrounds are quite a bit smaller than Miniboon's, but that's one of them that we get at low energy. So this is for the Miniboon case, you're saying. This is a good point. Yeah, we do have position resolution. We have, at least for the first round of analysis, just stuck to examining the excess in the energy distribution. I'm actually not sure that that's something people are working on. I think it's hard to, like, it's sort of a heuristic way that Miniboon has looked at the excess. There is less, you know, concrete things that you can say about the radial distribution of the Miniboon excess. And so you could do that analysis, but it's hard to map that to a physics model.
Okay, and I have another silly question. So if the photons are actually a problem for an indication, what happens with the, so in the beam?
Mm-hmm.
What about the eta?
Yeah, so the etas are also part of the BNB simulation. Yeah, it's a small contribution to the...
Is it
equally
as high as the
fines,
roughly?
I think.
You mean at the target or inside
of
the target?
You raise at the target's etas?
Yeah.
But
no, they degrade photons.
But those photons are going to get absorbed before they reach.
He's saying are photons produced inside of the detector?
Yeah, exactly.
The pions are produced by neutrinos inside of the detector.
Yeah.
There are two issues here. This world is difficult because there's the issue of the hadronic modeling at the target, and there's the issue of the hadronic modeling inside the detector.
Okay,
the worry is mostly on the latter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry, I didn't understand. There's any photons in the there's like 500 meters of distance between the target and the detector, so you're only going to get neutrinos really that are produced in the target, or you know other non-interacting particles
inside of the detector too, and they need to be taken into account. Right? I'm not sure how well Genie or these generators describe Hader production.
Yeah, I'm also not.
I would be surprised if it was well described.
This is one of the reasons we looked for CCQE only and didn't try to account for all of these other. I mean that's a very difficult problem for neutrino physics. So. Okay, so I'll just give you a quick description of sparse SSNet. We use this is a network that performs pixel level labeling of our images using these sparse convolution and use ResNet architecture. And so basically what you get from this network is a one hot label for each pixel in your image based on whether the network thinks it's a highly ionizing particle, it's associated with a minimum ionizing particle, or an electromagnetic shower. And there are different subcategories of shower, but to really just kind of display the power of sparse SSNet. I'll show some images here where you have the charge bit, sort of the charge level image that comes out of MicroBoon. And so this is what you read from your wire planes. And then you can see after you pass this image through sparse SSNet, it correctly labels this showery-like thing as an electromagnetic shower. And the small stubby track at this vertex as a highly ionizing particle, so probably a proton. And you can see that sparse SSNet also does quite well with more complicated images. For example, this here looks like a charged current pi naught event where you produce a muon. So this is maybe a muon neutrino producing a muon, a proton, and then there's two photons, presumably from the pi naught decay. And so sparse SSNet is pretty strong at labeling our images. And this is sort of our first level of analysis. I'll jump all the way to our second CNN. This is the multi-particle identification network. And so the purpose here is to take a full image, and MPID will output the likelihood that any given particle exists in that image. We consider five different classes of particles: protons, electrons, photons, muons, and charged pions. And just as an example, this is a simulated, totally unphysical event. Well, maybe not unphysical, but I don't think there was any specific interaction behind it, where you create an electron, a proton, and a photon. And you can see that MPID does a pretty reasonable job determining the particle content of that image. So this is another way that we can make cuts in our analysis. So all of these, this first chain here gets fed into our selection channels. We have three different samples that we isolate. We have our 1E1P selection, which is our signal channel. It's where the Miniboon excess might show up. We also have a pi naught selection and a one muon, one proton, new mu interaction selection. And these are predominantly to constrain the backgrounds in our 1E1P analysis. So the way that we make our 1E1P sample is we first start with some broad data quality requirements. For example, this is where we require a forward-going proton consistent with CCQE kinematics. Then we use an ensemble of boosted decision trees to create a PID variable that we use to accept true new CCQE events and reject backgrounds. And these are based on a number of variables, kinematic, like the electron and proton energies and angles, and topological variables that are derived from sparse SSNet information, for example. And then we make some particle content requirements using the output of the multiparticle identification network. So for example, we can require the probability of a muon or photon in the final state to be low according to MPID. And so the result of this is a very pure sample of electron neutrinos from the booster neutrino beam. And so this is our predicted event rate as a function of neutrino energy. The pink events are true new CCQE events in our prediction. The purple events are other new ECC interactions. And then the green is the background, is our non-new E background that comes from, for example, muon neutrino interactions in MicroBoon or cosmic rays. And then sitting on top of this prediction here is a dashed blue line, and this indicates that simplified LEE phenomenological model that I described earlier. The weights is a function of true neutrino energy. And so you can get a sense of where the median Miniboon excess might sit on top of our prediction. We get about 76% purity for true new CCQE events and about 6.6% efficiency. This is by design. We picked a very exclusive signal channel to optimize for purity in this analysis. We also select a sample of new mu, 1μ1p events. And the way that we select the sample is very similar to the 1E1P sample. And we get a 1μ1 proton sample that has roughly the same purity and efficiency for selecting true new mu CCQE events. And the data Monte Carlo agreement is quite good in this channel. There's maybe a small excess, but everything is within systematic error. Yep.
So it looks like your procedure is cutting out a lot of low energy CCQE events. Is that basically correct?
There's a convolution with the beam shape here. So the BNB peaks at around 500 MeV and then dies off at lower energies. And this is just the kinematics of the meson decay chain. You do cut out some events because, in general, it's harder to reconstruct an electron, really, at the lowest energies. And you know, protons are, as you get to lower proton energies, they quickly don't really show up in your detector around like tens of MeV.
I'm just wondering if you played with that a little bit, because in testing the Miniboon excess, you really want as many like low energy events as you can get.
Yeah, exactly. No, I agree. This, so I'll show a plot that describes this later, but like our analysis, you know, part of the reason we focused on QE is that it peaks, or CCQE is that it peaks at low energy. And because of that, our so the sort of ratio to the LEE model to the predicted background is pretty high at low energies in our analysis. This is not true of the other analyses. So we get a little bit better signal to background ratio at the lowest energies. The trade-off here is that we have pretty low stats. And so, you know, this is why we do multiple analyses. So we have, you know, analyses that are limited by statistics or systematics or efficiency. Yes. Okay. So there are, of course, uncertainties on the prediction. In our analysis, there are five main channels of uncertainties. I show all of them here in the bottom plots for the 1UNP and 1μUNP channels. But the most dominant uncertainties come from our flux modeling. So this is coming from the BNB simulation. These uncertainties are shared with Miniboon. We use the same flux simulation. We have neutrino nucleus interaction uncertainties that come from the Gini event generator that we use. We have hadron reinteraction uncertainties that come from JANT4, and this is where final state interaction uncertainties come from. For example, pion absorption in resonant events. All of that's handled on the JANT4 side. And then we also have detector response model uncertainties. These are uncertainties that are estimated in situ using cosmic muons that cross through the detector. So you can, there's a paper I can point you to if you're interested in more details on our detector uncertainty evaluation. But those are the main uncertainties. We can constrain those uncertainties using our muon channel. So the nu e and the nu mu events are highly correlated in our detector. So they're correlated because of the flux. They both come, so the largest source of muon and electron neutrinos in our detector comes from the same pion decay chain at the target. And so the kinematics of the nu mu and the nu e in this decay chain are highly correlated. There's also correlations on the flux end. So we're looking for the same interaction, charge current quasi-elastic scattering, and up to effects from the charge lepton mass. Those cross sections are the same, and they're you know, the uncertainties are correlated in the nu e and the nu mu measurements. And so what you get if you create a correlation matrix in the energy distribution of the 1E1P and 1μUNP channels, you can see that the off-block diagonal correlations between the two channels are quite high. And so we leverage the fact that this covariance matrix formalism describes a multivariate Gaussian distribution of the 1E1P and 1μUNP prediction as a function of energy. And we can condition the 1E1P prediction and uncertainty on the observation in the nu mu channel. And so if you, you know, calculate the conditioned prediction and uncertainty or covariance in the electron channel, you get the constrained prediction and the constrained covariance shown here. And this is what we use as our final prediction and uncertainty in our 1E1P analysis. So the constraint procedure gives us a small increase in the expected number of 1E1P events. And it gives us a substantial reduction of our systematic error. You can see that effect on this right plot here. In some bins, we get about a 50% reduction in our systematic error going through this constraint procedure. I'll note that our analysis is statistically limited. So while this constraint procedure helps, we're still limited by our statistical error. And then we use this constraint prediction and uncertainty to evaluate whether or not we see an excess. And so this is the result that we see. We observed 25 events in data compared to our background prediction of about 28 or 29 events. And I'm going to leave this on the screen while I take another drink of water. But if anyone has questions, go for it. I'll spend the next few slides going through this result.
I will just point out that there is a small but important deficit right on the peak of the expectation.
Yeah.
If Miniboon was correct, you would see the dashed blue. But they see a small deficit right on that region.
Yeah, so this deficit is important. We see an underfluctuation.
It's not as bad in your analysis, but in the other analysis, it's even worse, right?
It's more apparent, definitely. So people have gone and fit that to nu e disappearance. I'll show that later. Yeah, in general, we do see a bit of a deficit where you'd expect the LEE. So, you know, by eye, we're not consistent with an electron neutrino enhancement in the BNB, such that you would explain Miniboon. So yeah, let's dig into this result. So the first thing we can do are goodness of fit tests of our data to our prediction. We use the combined Neiman-Pearson chi-squared test statistic, which is supposed to account for the low statistics regime that we're in. For the next slides, I'll define H-naught as the hypothesis, which is the prediction without the LEE model, so just the stacked histogram. H1 is the prediction when you add this median LEE model in. And in general, we observe tension actually with both H-naught and H1 in this analysis at about the 2.5 and 3.6 sigma level, just for this chi-squared goodness of fit test. There are a few reasons you can see by eye, we see a little bit of a deficit at low energies. We have a bin that's pretty high over here. We do see something that's not quite consistent, but we'll evaluate that. So like I said, we see this tension with H-naught. So we look at the other variables that we isolate in this analysis to see if we see similar tension with the null hypothesis. So for example, I show here electron energy, electron angle, and the neutrino energy reconstructed under a quasi-elastic assumption using the electron energy and angle. And in general, we observe less tension with the null hypothesis in these other variables that are not the neutrino energy. We see similar features in this quasi-elastic reconstructed neutrino energy that we see in the calorimetric reconstruction, which is our main definition for the neutrino energy. We see a sort of an enhancement at about 800 MeV, but in general, better agreement with H-naught. I'll note that these distributions here don't apply the 1 mu1p constraint. It's only designed for the calorimetric energy distribution. These are three of 30 odd plots or so that you can look at distributions in different kinematic variables for the events in our sample. All of these plots are in our paper if you're interested, and in my backup slides if you really want one. So we can then perform a simple hypothesis test, so a delta chi-squared between H-naught and H1. And you can see the value of delta chi-squared that we observe for the data here in this in this vertical blue line. And you can see the predicted distribution of delta's chi-squared values, which we obtained by throwing pseudo-experiments under H-naught and H1 from our prediction. And then in general, we're on the low side of these delta chi-squared distributions for both hypotheses. We get about 2.1 sigma tension with H-naught and 3.6 sigma tension with H1. So we're in general, we have more tension with the LEE hypothesis. And so to get a final result for our for this two hypothesis test, we have to use what's called the CLS method, which accounts for an under fluctuation in our data or a fluctuation in the favorable direction if you're trying to constrain a model. And after applying the CLS method, we can conclude that we reject H1, the LEE-based hypothesis, in favor of the null hypothesis with a significance of about 2.4 sigma. So after accounting for that under fluctuation. So that's the conclusion of the delta chi-squared test. The final test we've done is a signal strength scaling test, where we take the LEE model and we allow it to float by a flat normalization parameter x. So this is the signal strength scaling test. And we can obtain confidence intervals on this parameter x using the Feldman-Cousins procedure, which is sort of based on throwing pseudo experiments at each value of x. You can see here the confidence level with which we can rule out each value of x as a function of x obtained from the Feldman-Cousins procedure. And from this, we can draw confidence intervals at the 1 sigma, 90%, and 2 sigma levels here. You can compare that to the Mini-Boon model, which is at a scaling of 1.0. And just for the eye, we've drawn on this plot the quoted statistical only and statistical plus systematic error from the Mini-Boon measurement. So this is just from their paper. We haven't evaluated this ourselves. By the eye, it sort of gives you a sense of where we stand by eye. And the conclusion is that we rule out the a signal strength scaling of 38% of the Mini-Boon excess at the 2 sigma level. So we are just one of four different electron neutrino results that have come out from Micro-Boon. So our exclusive two-body CCQE analysis is here on the top left. But there's also an inclusive one electron with anything else in the final state analysis from Wiresel. Using wire cell-based reconstruction. And then there's a mini-moon-like channel using Pandora-based reconstruction, which looks for an electron with no pions in the final state. And this is partitioned into a channel with at least one proton and a channel with no protons. And if you look at these plots by eye, so the median LEE model shows up as the red dashed line in each plot. And as Matthias alluded to, a lot of these experiments see a bit of a deficit in the region where you'd expect the LEE to show up. And so in general, most of these are inconsistent with an LEE-like enhancement of electron neutrinos, with the exception of this one electron and nothing else analysis, which is background dominated. So it's the least sensitive analysis. Okay, so
the inclusive is background dominated, but that one is the least newly pure sample, right?
So yeah.
Is the less interesting one in that
one. Yeah, sorry. I think I was using a different definition of background.
Yeah. That moves photons, right?
Exactly. So you have the most contamination from non-electron neutrino events. You have your the least LEE model to no LEE model ratio as well in this channel. We can describe what we see in these analyses in a few plots. So here I show in the LEE enhanced region, so the lowest energies up to 500 MeV, the ratio of observed events to predicted events. So at 1.0, and this is the prediction without the LEE hypothesis. So 1.0 in this plot is the describes the prediction without this LEE enhancement. The red line describes the ratio you would expect to observe under the LEE hypothesis. And then you can see where each analysis you can see the data that each analysis observed here, where in general, three of the analyses are sitting below even the null hypothesis. And the one that's sitting above is the most background dominated channel. And then this kind of gets at the question you had earlier, which was optimizing for low energy electron neutrino events. And so in the lowest energy regions, our analysis has quite a large ratio of LEE events to non-LEE events compared to the other analyses, but our error bars are a bit bigger because we are statistically limited. So this kind of summarizes that goal of our analysis. Also, each analysis has done a signal strength scaling test, which I show here. So this is where we scale the LEE model by that flat scaling parameter x, and we can place confidence interval Feldman-Cousins-derived constraints on the scaling parameter. And you can see the sensitivity of each analysis compared to the observed rejection. So the sensitivity is in red, and then the observed confidence intervals at 1 and 2 sigma are in black. That sensitivity is at 2 sigma. And so you can see, at least in our analysis, we're doing much better than our sensitivity owing to that underfluctuation at the lowest energies. But in general, the three most sensitive analyses are inconsistent with a signal strength scaling of 1.0 at about the 2 to 3 sigma level. So
your deficit is the most.
That's why I wanted to put a caveat on that statement. Yeah, we have, depending on how you cut it. So if you do the signal strength scaling test, it seems like it matters quite a bit. This is probably a product of the fact that we're statistically limited. But in any case, I would say that the quoted result that I trust the most from our analysis is the CLS method delta chi squared test, which is a 2.4 sigma rejection of the LEE enhancement. Okay, so what about the photons? I've talked a lot about electrons here. How am I doing on time?
You have 5 minutes.
Oh, shoot. Okay. I'll quickly talk about the photons. We also looked for neutral current delta to N gamma decays in microboon. You need a scaling of about a factor of 3 to explain the miniboon excess. And the analysis that did this, the most sensitive channel, looked for 1 gamma and 1 proton in the final state. And it's inconsistent with the scaling required to explain the miniboon excess about the 95% confidence level. So the full first results disfavor electron neutrino and photon neutral current delta decays as explanations of the miniboon excess. So the question remains, what is the miniboon excess? The sort of original model that explains the miniboon excess is the sterile neutrino model. I flashed this slide earlier. So microboon's initial results don't make any explicit claims about the sterile neutrino interpretation of miniboon. But you can go ahead and do these analyses. So just for reference, this is the complete data set result from miniboon. And traditionally, miniboon fits their excess to this nu mu to nu e sterile-driven oscillation. And so you can see, as a function of the sterile neutrino mixing parameters and the delta m squared, the preferred regions in that phase space to explain the miniboon excess in these colored contours here, that you can see the same for the LS&D anomaly, so they sort of lie on top of each other. And then here you can see the miniboon excess. So this is the background subtracted miniboon excess here. compared to the sort of best fit and one sigma allowed regions to from the sterile neutrino hypothesis. And actually, even by eye, you can see that it does an okay job explaining the excess at higher energies. But at the lowest energies, it seems like there's something else happening. The excess is sitting even on top of the sterile neutrino prediction. So I'll come back to this later. But that's the state of the mini boons to neutrino oscillation fit. We've actually done, so as part of the mini boon collaboration, we've done some work fitting the mini boon excess to a full 3+1 model, which incorporates not only nu mu to nu e oscillations, but electron neutrino disappearance and muon neutrino disappearance. And we've also taken that fit and done a combined fit with the microboon CCQE analysis to see if that changes the picture. And so you can see the result here. In red are the contours we get from our 3+1 miniboon only fit. And then when we add in the CCQE data, the allowed regions are what's shown in blue here. And so the conclusion here is that because these allowed regions are quite stable, it doesn't seem like the microboon CCQE result can say much about the miniboon excess. Miniboon is driving this fit much more than microboon. I'll say we're working on doing the same thing with the wire cell analysis, which has larger statistics in general. So look out for that in the near future. Other people in the neutrino community have also recast microboon's results into bounds on a sterile model. So for example, Mateus has done some work with some collaborators, which is kind of, I'll summarize it in this plot on the bottom right, which shows the constraints that microboon can set in muon 2 electron appearance parameter space. So you can see the miniboon preferred region in the shaded region here. And then the constraints derived from this analysis from the CCQE channel, so the analysis I presented today, and the inclusive channel. And you can see at 3 sigma, they're starting to dig into the preferred region from miniboon, but they haven't excluded all of the parameter space yet. There's also a paper which fits the microboon result to a nu e disappearance model. There are some caveats about that analysis, but in any case, the point is people are looking into these things. I just will quickly say that there is tension in the global picture if you go beyond miniboon and microboon. If you include a short baseline accelerator, long baseline accelerator and atmospheric experiments, and short baseline reactor and gallium experiments, there's a lot of tension between the channels that are looking for appearance from a sterile neutrino and muon or electron neutrino disappearance. And this is something that global fit groups consistently see. It becomes difficult to accommodate a sterile neutrino within global data because of this tension. So there is a big caveat to the sterile neutrino model. And this is for this reason, the community has produced a lot of different models that can explain the miniboon excess. This is like maybe 1% of the papers that have explained the miniboon excess on archive. And they're just for as this slice of models, you can see them grouped into models that produce true electrons, true photons, or E plus E minus pairs. And this is really the drive of miniboon and microboon, sorry, for the foreseeable future is to now look at these more exotic models or start to reinterpret our own results into bounds on these other models that could explain the miniboon excess. You can see them mapped to the scorecard of final state topology and model type here. So I'll just flash this summary in general. Microboon doesn't see an enhancement of electron neutrinos or neutral current delta to N gamma decays. So we disfavor the most common interpretations of the miniboon excess. And now the path forward is to start looking at more exotic interpretations and analyze the rest of our data. So that is the end of the microboon part of the talk. I have some slides on CCM. I don't know, maybe I can.
Yeah, maybe we leave it for discussion.
Yeah, so if you want to ask me about CCM, I will flash the summary slide in case you want to ask me about it. But in general, it's a decay at rest, it's like a beam dump decay at rest neutrino source that has some sensitivity to dark sector models because you can look for dark sector model production within the beam and look for coherent nuclear scattering in the detector or electromagnetic activity. What's that? Alpha here? Yeah, this is, this is like GB, this is the coupling to the baryon current here. So it's GB squared over 4 pi.
So this is an anomaly symmetry?
Yes.
Sorry.
And why isn't this constrained by supernovae?
There are supernova constraints. I don't think they show up on this plot. So this is a leptophobic model. So you're thinking of like stellar cooling constraints from
photon.
The dark photon model is here. It's the vector photon model. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, this is I flashed through the models kind of quickly. But yeah, this is so CCM has done some work looking into like a dark photon vector portal model, which you look for, you know, kinetic mixing with the dark photon, and then you look for, and this creates your dark matter, in this case complex scalars, and then you look for the coherent scattering in your detector. You just look for an excess in your reconstructed energy distribution.
Let's talk about it later.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. I think that's the case.
This is large capital, it's epsilon squared.
It's because
the y-axis is some weird.
So the y-axis is like cast in the annihilation rate of dark matter.
Let's discuss it afterwards.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good, yeah. Okay, so maybe I'll flash on the analyses that CCM has already done. So, or maybe I'll quickly say the detection strategy. You have this really short beam pulse at CCM, and you can separate your BSM particles that are in time with the beam, so they arrive promptly in the detector, from the main background, which are beam-related neutrons, which show up a bit later. And so you can use your pre-beam to estimate your background. And then you identify a window where you expect to be neutron-free, and you look for an excess of, for example, dark sector particles in that region of interest. And so that's sort of the idea. A number of dark sector models have been explored by CCM. So there's this vector portal model, which, yeah, we should talk about where the BBN constraints would show up on this. We've also examined a leptophobic model where you have a gauged U1 baryon number symmetry. And the associated vector boson. And so you can set constraints on that, also by coherent scattering within the detector. I guess since I'm running out of time, I'll flash. You can also do searches for axion-like particles in your detector. And so from the target, you can get production of axions from Primakov scattering. And you can look for inverse Primakov or decay to two photons within the detector. It gives sort of a high energy electromagnetic deposit, and you can set constraints based on those energy depositions. You can also look for couplings of the axion to charged leptons. And so you can create them by inverse Compton scattering and then look for the Compton scattering or E plus E minus pair production of ELPs within the detector. And so these are the projected sensitivities of CCM 200, which will run for 3 years at Los Alamos. The sensitivities are given with the like nominal background assumptions and a background-free analysis. So the actual exclusion will lie somewhere between these two curves in each of these plots. There are some exotic interpretations of CCM that involve dark sector particles. A group at Texas A&M in Los Alamos has looked at a model involving vector portal dark matter and pseudoscalar or scalar portal dark matter as explanations of the mini-boon excess. You produce these vector or pseudoscalar particles in charged pion decays or charged meson decays at the mini-boon source, and then you detect them either by sort of this upscattering and then decay of the dark matter particle or by this inverse Primakov scattering. And in general, you can fit the energy and angular distributions of mini-boon quite well in these type of models, especially the scalar and pseudoscalar models. And this is something CCM will have sensitivity to over its three-year running. So it can start to look for energy depositions of these axion-like particles, for example, and set constraints on the preferred region to explain mini-boon. So CCM has just finished a prototype running phase, CCM 120. And CCM 200 is currently in the commissioning phase. It'll run for 3 years at Los Alamos. And it's projected to have sensitivity to a number of these dark sector models, including axion-like particle scenarios. And so to do this, we have to CCM200 is designed to push down the energy thresholds by better photo coverage, shielding, and argon filtration to build increase the purity of the argon. So, and this will be necessary if if CCM wants to detect coherent scattering, which was sort of the original design goal of the experiment. So stay tuned for CCM200 results coming out in the near future. And yeah, I didn't spend much time on this, so feel free to ask me questions about it. But anyway, thanks for having me. Happy to take questions.
Questions? Thanks, Nick. I think I should say the signal model that you have for Miniboon that you tested with Microboon is one choice of a signal model. So when you quote 2.5 sigma or 3.5 sigma exclusion, that's assuming that your excess in Miniboon looks exactly like the data central value minus background central value.
Yeah.
Which, as we pointed out, it's not a good assumption.
Yeah.
Miniboon is systematically dominated, right?
Mm-hmm.
With systematics on the background, which means the shape of that excess is also very malleable within one sigma, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
So if you change the shape of that, your Microboon interpretation will also change substantially, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is work that you guys did in your paper. I totally agree. So, what we really set constraints on is the median interpretation of the Miniboon excess. So, sort of exactly what you would have to scale the backgrounds by to match the literal Miniboon excess.
No, but so.
I mean, you see
it. But there, I think.
Beetle with a shape, whatever, but I mean, there's no
excess. But the hard question here, I agree with you. Nothing changes the fact that Microboon doesn't see an excess.
Yeah.
But the hard question is, should Microboon have seen an excess? Like, if I pick a model like the steroneutrino model, as bad as it is, horrible, right?
Yeah.
But if I pick that model, do a fit to Miniboon data, I get some region of preference. If I then take that model, and I don't do this crazy template thing, and just ask the question, what are the constraints of Microboon on that parameter space?
Yeah.
You will see that you don't touch the Microboon region with the CCQ analysis that Nick discussed. You don't even touch the region. So the answer to that, for the CCQE, it's Microboon shouldn't have seen an excess, even if Miniboon was correct. The only reason why it looks like Microboon set strong limits is because they pick this specific signal template.
Why shouldn't they the model should give you an excess.
No. The parameter that explains Miniboon,
yeah.
You have to ask, does that model at that point in parameter space give you an excess in Microboon?
But what you're saying is that the model that explains Miniboon doesn't actually give you as big an excess as Miniboon.
But it must give you an excess.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It does give you an excess. And so then you're saying, if I then say, what is that model's prediction for Microboon? The prediction is consistent with what they're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's all.
Yeah.
So they're using, you know, a low energy excess model that, you know, is just a naive fit to the Miniboon excess. So he's saying, if you try to do like the most well motivated model you can cook up, then you're not yet at a sensitivity statistically at Microboon to throw.
Yeah. Exactly. I have something else to say about that point too. I think it's a great point. So the reason that you get these, like, I think, CCQ analysis doesn't seem that sensitive when you cast the constraint in terms of sterile neutrinos, and that's really driven by, I go to the front of the talk, or was it? No, it was when I started talking about sterile neutrinos. So it's here. So you can see that the sterile neutrino model predicts more events at higher energies, but it really doesn't predict this enhancement at low energies. And you know, the CCQ analysis has most of its statistical power from rejecting an event or an excess at the lowest energies. And if your model doesn't capture that, you know, CCQE is not a great place. Our specific CCQE analysis is not a great place to look at the sterile neutrino model.
Like, for the room, these one additional sterile neutrino out of massive and EV models are just completely obliterated once you bring in all the other neutrino data.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't we just for the sake of doing something, you know, that would work for everything, like throwing in like an extra neutrino, an extra interaction, or like a few extra sterile neutrinos. I mean, because that's the actual parameter space that's even.
So I also work on some global fit work at MIT, and that's exactly what we're doing. You can argue about whether it makes sense to introduce multiple EV scale sterile neutrinos, but it is a better model to try to get a sense of the compatibility of the data. And so we do 3+2 fits, or at least we're working on one right now. We're also working on fits where you turn on a decay channel for one of the neutrinos. So we're starting to explore this more complex model space, but the thing to remember is there are more parameters that you turn on when you introduce more particles. And if you want to fit all of the experiments at the same time, the combinatorics start to blow up quite a bit. And so it becomes difficult. This is why people have fit just the generic EV scale sterile neutrino model for so long, because there's only two parameters, or depending on what you're doing, there's three or so parameters that you're really fiddling with, UE4, UMU4, and the delta M squared. And so, yeah.
We need better model.
Yeah. If you put those bounds on this plot, it's
there's not a better model made.
Right, but I mean, seriously, if you put the other bounds on this plot, it's just the plot,
Yeah, exactly. So that's why when we talk about casting these results in terms of a sterile neutrino model, I think the value is sort of what Mateus was saying, comparing results based on a concrete physics model between two experiments.
Your fit. If I use CQB only, nothing changes. That's what that plot is telling you.
Yeah.
In this model, right?
Yeah, I'm less worried about that than putting all the other plots around there.
Yeah. So I wouldn't look at this plot and say, Miniboon is probably still sterile neutrinos, because there's many caveats to that picture. It's just that if you think about if you cast everything in terms of a specific physics model, you start to get at the real sensitivity of Microboon.
I agree. The statement is, at this point, nothing minimal works for the short baseline data. If it's something due to new physics, it's going to be very weird.
It would be cool to see how weird. I mean, I think Joaquin back in 2018, they dove into some few extra sterile neutrinos with extra matter effect stuff.
With these EV states.
With extra matter, so you need to add extra.
Oh, and extra interactions. Yeah.
What background do you have that will explain this? That's the big question.
What backgrounds in the Microboon analysis? Yeah, okay. This is, so the most popular backgrounds to explain the Miniboon excess are, up to the Microboon analysis was an enhancement of these neutral current delta decays. You're getting at standard model backgrounds within the detector, right?
Okay, yeah.
This is a branching ratio that's never been measured at a neutrino experiment before. It's very difficult to measure a neutral current excitation of a nucleus and then a decay to a single photon. T2K tried to do this, they set a limit on that branching ratio. Let me see if I have a backup slide on this. I have some backup slides on the photon analysis. Yeah.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. So, does this have the T2K bound? I guess I don't have the T2K bound. But anyway, you can recast the Markovan measurement of delta to N gamma. So they set this 95% upper limit on the scaling required to explain Miniboon. You can recast that in terms of a constraint on the branching ratio. And it's, I think it turns out it's a few times larger than the standard model branching ratio, or at least the GD predicted branching ratio delta to N gamma decays. And that's about a factor of 50 times better than the T2K limit. So this is a really hard measurement to make. Depending on your tolerance for confidence intervals, that's still a possibility at about the 5% level. It's only ruled out at the 95% level. You can argue about pi naughts. Miniboon's done a lot of work to constrain them in situ. They measure their own pi naught rate, and they use that to constrain the pi naught rate that they would expect as backgrounds in their signal in their electron-like channel. We talked about the radial distribution earlier. That's one way to also get at whether the excess is due to neutral current pi naught events. But That's another pretty common standard model interpretation. So yeah, I agree. These are the important questions to ask first before you add 3 plus n sterile neutrinos.
This is a healthy LSND, a 30-year-old problem.
Well, things take time. What can you do?
Data is data,
it doesn't matter how old it is,
it
kind of go away.
Yeah, so actually, Joachim Kopp and Finner and Bernard, I think, did some work where they took modern generators. So Miniboon took data around, they used a generator called Nuance, which is definitely outdated at this point. So they did some work where they took modern Genie event generation, Genie, but also I think other neutrino event generators, and they reestimated the I-naught contamination within Miniboon, and also the delta to N-gamma contamination, and the uncertainties from these modern generators. And the uncertainty still stands above, you know, the estimations from modern event generators. The conclusion is that it's very difficult to find, you know, a combination of mismodeled standard model backgrounds that can explain the Miniboon excess. And so I can point you to that paper if you're interested, but this is really, I think that's a reference for the state of standard model background interpretations.
Call it the Alfarelli cocktail.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you make all backgrounds move in the right direction, can you, you know, for some speculation, can you explain the excess?
Unless you have counted all backgrounds properly.
Ah.
Could there be a
The
stuff was mentioned about
the beam.
By the way, we should start recording now.
Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you, Nick. Yeah,
yeah, thanks for having me.
You mentioned something about things interacting with
the flux uncertainty screen.
Yeah.
The question is, have all backgrounds been accounted?
Well, you know, there are always unknown unknowns, right? And so this is something that takes time to look into. One comment on these, you know, whether we modeled the beam correctly, or, you know, I wasn't alive when this happened, but whether they modeled the beam correctly. There was an experiment that was run at the booster neutrino beam to characterize the neutrino flux. And so this, I think it's called the Hawk experiment. It's like a very small scintillator or something like that. And all of the sort of the BNB simulation was tuned to data measured by this detector. And the question becomes, is there some process in the beam that this detector measurement wouldn't have been sensitive to? And so one of the things we're going to look into, or that we're planning to look into, is sort of the neutrino energy range that that detector was really sensitive to, and whether there's some wiggle room outside of the sensitivity of that to, you know, introduce more low energy neutrinos into the beam from some unknown channel. Maybe you can parameterize it in like an agnostic way. You don't know what's happening, but in any case, that's what we're looking into. It's difficult to do that, which is why it hasn't been done yet. But yeah, it's a good question.
Get coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah,
coffee.
Thanks again.